we've got 1.5 billion hectares of farmland out there, and all we have to do is change the way we use it to make it the most effective single way of reducing the amount of carbon in the atmosphere.
Welcome to the 2 Degrees Show, the UK's only weekly programme dedicated to climate change, which is produced for Resonance FM in London and rebroadcast by half a dozen other community radio stations around the UK. This week, we're looking at the role that organic agriculture can play in helping to stabilise the climate. Soil Association Chair Craig Sams made some extraordinary claims at the recent RSA No Way Back conference about this. As well as being chair of the Soil Association, Sams is the founder of Whole Earth Foods and Green and Black's Chocolate. So we're devoting the next half hour to an interview with Sams, and the first thing I asked was just how big he thought the role of organic farming was in helping us avoid the most dangerous levels of climate change. Here he is, speaking on the phone from his home in Hastings, recorded just before Christmas.
The key thing here is that we're heading to a situation where the Earth will have a net emission in carbon equivalents of 7 billion tons a year, and that's a disaster. And in order to stabilize our climate, we have to get that down to 2.8 billion, which means there has to be a saving of 4.2 billion tons of carbon a year. Now, organic farming emits half the fossil fuel of conventional farming because they don't use nitrates, because they don't use pesticides, because they are less industrial, because they tend to use more human input and less chemical input. So if you have the agricultural emissions, you've got a saving of almost 1 billion tons there. In addition, organic farming can capture more than 1 billion tons a year of carbon out of the atmosphere. And arguably even more if there was some reward for it. So we're up to 2 billion. And nitrates alone are responsible for a third of 1 billion. So we're up to 2.3 at the very minimum that just a simple change in farming techniques could reduce for if that 4.2 billion target. So that immediately reduces, it eases the pressure to cut back on other emissions, and it gives us time to get renewable energy systems into place, insulation, all the other things that we could and should be doing. But in the meantime, we've got sitting right outside our cities land that is capable of playing a significant role in reducing atmospheric greenhouse gas.
Besides burning fossil fuels, the other great human contribution to climate change is the change that's occurred in land use over the last...
last 150 years in particular.
Right.
Up till then, land use was marginally, you could say, damaging to climate, but not in any significant way. But from the 1850s, there was massive migration to the Midwest of the United States, and an area of land the size of Europe was plowed up and exploited in a way that European land never had been, because European land it had a history of a balanced use, rotations, lots of pasture. Whereas the American Midwest was really, I mean, apart from anything else, a farmer got 160 acres free if they farmed every inch of it. And they were given, I think, 6 or 7 years to show that everything was farmed. Then they got the freehold title to the land. So, you know, that produced a massive sort of explosion of food and population, but also actually damaged European farming because, you know, so much cheap food was coming in from North America, Canadian wheat and American beef primarily. But what it also meant was that an awful lot of land was getting farmed and not in any sort of sustainable way. And then subsequently we've seen the industrialization of agriculture in places like China and India with the Green Revolution. and opening up of new, the Argentine pampas and the rainforests of Brazil to soybean and maize production. So all of these, those are the main sort of new inputs. So if you add all that up, since 1850, which is only 150 years ago, half of all the greenhouse gas emissions have come from farming. And fossil fuels only really started to catch up in the sort of post-war period, in the sort of 50s and 60s. But up till then, it was farming that was really doing most of the damage, you know, creating the sort of level of greenhouse gas that didn't really, you know, make such a difference to climate change, but nonetheless provided a base on which to build, if you want to look at it like that.
I mean, deforestation is also a change in land use that contributes to climate change. Are you saying that a lot of deforestation is actually due to the expansion of agriculture?
That's obviously true. And when you deforest land, you're, you know, an awful lot of the wood just gets burned. I mean, in some areas it was used for building, but certainly sometimes it's just too much wood and it's just not worth it to move it. You just want to get rid of it so that you can get cattle out there or soybeans or whatever else. But when you take a hectare of land, you've got 30 to 40 tons of carbon in your average hectare of land in our sort of climate. So you can lose a ton a year for 30 or 40 years before you get down to the bare minimum, at which point, you know, farmers tend at that stage to sort of find some kind of equilibrium, and, you know, chemical fertilizers and a bit of no-till farming just keeps it from getting any worse, from otherwise it desertifies and you've got nothing.
Right. So what are the key ways in which modern agriculture has contributed to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere?
Well, when you use nitrate fertilizer, I mean, there are two main things, tractors and fertilizers. Tractors do two things. One is they plow more deeply than horse-drawn plows. So they are bringing up carbon-rich humus from deeper in the soil. And it kind of gives you an extension to your, you know, you're actually accelerating your withdrawals, if you like, from the carbon bank of the soil. When horses are used in agriculture, obviously you've got a bit of a problem in that, you know, a quarter of your land has to go to raising oats and having pasture to feed the horses that pull the plows. So tractors did two things. They increased productivity, but they also increased the speed at which carbon was evaporated out of the soil. Nitrate fertilizers, which really, although they'd been around, didn't really take off until the subsidy policies of Western governments encouraged their use after World War II. Nitrates do a couple of things. One is they break down the humus content of soil. So they accelerate the carbon loss of soil. But also, they are a greenhouse gas. They produce a greenhouse gas as nitrous oxide in their own right. And the equivalent of about a third of a billion tons of carbon are lost into the atmosphere as nitrous oxide. So even though it's not a lot of nitrous oxide is 300 times more potent as a greenhouse gas. It has a higher refractive index than carbon dioxide. So like methane or CFCs, once it's up there, it actually is much more damaging than CO2.
Sorry, did you also mention the fossil fuels used in the production of fertilizers?
Yeah, fossil fuels. Yeah. Every ton of nitrates uses 5 tons of methane, which is a hydrocarbon, so it produces carbon dioxide in the process. Yeah. So we're burning up natural gas to make nitrate fertilizers. And, of course, all the pesticides are derived from fossil fuels, and all are quite in energy-intensive processes to make insecticides and herbicides.
Obviously, we've got this historic emissions in the atmosphere of greenhouse gases that have been due to modern agricultural methods. What is the potential, in your view, for if there was a massive switchback to more traditional organic methods of farming, what's the potential for reabsorbing some of that carbon within the system?
Well, organic farmers now have a much higher rate of, they don't lose carbon from their soil because organic standards basically don't allow it. So that, you know, the drive of organic standards and the regulatory process of certifying somebody as organic requires, among other things, that they are maintaining the carbon content of their soil. But you can go further, and the farmers who convert to organic have a steady increase in the humus content, and humus is carbon. It's a mixture of both carbon-rich bacteria and fungi and carbon in other non-living forms, locked up in a sort of slightly sticky goo. I mean, humus is what holds soil particles together, but it's a living material, and it's very rich in carbon. So organic farmers add carbon in general to their soil each year, but they aren't motivated to. You know, organic farmers do it because it comes from the heart. They believe in what they're doing, and that's just part of the process. If you went to those farmers or any farmers and said, right, we're going to measure the carbon in your soil every year, or we know that certain agricultural practices will have certain benefits, and so if you practice those practices, we will reward you for the theoretical carbon that you're adding to your soil, then farmers would farm in an even more carbon-conscious way. They would grow high biomass crops that they could plow in. And the ones that spring immediately to mind are switchgrass, miscanthus, and hemp, all of which can produce between 10 to 20 tons of biomass per hectare per year. And if you plow all of that in, you can put 3 or 4 tons of pure carbon into the soil, which, you know, is a phenomenal amount. There are 1.5 billion hectares of arable land alone on this planet, not to mention twice as much pasture. If you put a ton of carbon per hectare into the ground, that would be 1.5 billion tons per annum, which is nearly half of the reduction in carbon that we need to achieve in order to stabilize our climate.
Right, and that's as a higher rate of doing that than, say, afforestation.
Well, the thing about, say, miscanthus grass or switchgrass, they take 2 years to really get in their stride, and then they do it every year. Hemp does it from day one, but you have to plant it every year because it's an annual. The thing about miscanthus is it's perennial. If you plant a tree, it's really 15 or 20 years before it gets into its stride and starts really accumulating carbon. Up till then, it's really building up its root structure, getting and just preparing for its future, if you like. But it's not as fast growing. It doesn't have that sort of immediate carbon scrubbing effect that something like miscanthus grass would have.
But obviously a lot of land still needs to be kept for food production.
Well, that's where growing winter crops, cover crops, whether it's, you know, nitrogen-fixing crops or grasses, can capture carbon during the winter and still leave the land free for summer cropping. You've got opportunities with crops that have a high biomass and where, at the moment, if you take, for example, wheat. Wheat is now grown on very short stalks because that's more herbicide responsive and you get a higher yield of wheat. If you're prepared to sacrifice a bit of yield and grow tall-stemmed wheat, older British varieties, for example, like Marswijan, that grow so tall that they shade out weeds so you don't have a weed problem. But you do get a slightly lower yield of wheat, but it is good bread-making wheat. But you also have 2 to 3 times as much straw, and straw is practically all carbon. So you put that straw back into the ground, And it's a compromise. Everything is a compromise. You know, cheap food is not the only reason we exist on this planet. You know, it supports life, but it isn't the be-all and end-all of our existence. Mm.
To enable agriculture to be more climate-friendly in the future, you were talking about linking into the carbon pricing mechanisms that are emerging now. How could that be attached to food production?
Well, there is a carbon market emerging, and the EU it's really going to bite in the next 2 years when compliance with the Kyoto Agreement becomes compulsory in most countries other than the United States and Australia. And people are going to have to, particularly coal-fired power stations, the big emitters of carbon are going to have to balance their output by buying carbon credits in carbon exchanges. And carbon exchanges are like any other market. They operate on a basis of supply and demand. Now, the supply of carbon credits at the moment come from things like hydroelectric power stations in southern Spain, where they've dammed all those mountain rivers, and so they can sell carbon credits because they're carbon, if you like, carbon positive. They can sell their carbon credits on the European carbon exchange to people who need to buy them. And at the moment, the price of those credits works out at about 10 euros, 12 euros a ton. The fine next year is going to be 50 euros a ton, rising to 100 euros a ton for any company that hasn't got its credits purchased. So that's kind of an indication of where the price of carbon is going. Another comparison is in America, they already have quite a thriving market in nitrous oxide credits, although farmers are excluded from any requirement to buy them, but power stations and industrial emitters are required to. Nitrous oxide credits sell for $40,000 a ton, and on the basis that nitrous oxide is 300 times worse than carbon dioxide, you could expect carbon credits to be at around 1/300th of that, which is $130 a ton, which is 70 pounds a ton or 100 euros a ton. Yeah, but so it's a hell of a lot more, is the point I'm making. When the market gets to that point, if farmers are in there on the supply side of the equation, then they can sell the carbon that they've captured out of the atmosphere to those people who are emitting, so that gradually we become a carbon neutral planet. Farmers who are not doing that, in other words, farmers who are still using pesticides, not rotating properly, and just emitting carbon, more carbon from their land than they're sequestering or capturing, those farmers will have to go out and buy carbon credits. And they'll very quickly change their habits because, you know, farmers don't like to have to buy inputs, especially something like a carbon credit. If they can, you know, grow something on their land or change their agricultural practices to reflect the fact that there is value to carbon. At the moment, it's just irrelevant to most farmers. And that's where we're heading. You know, once there is demand for carbon, which is, and the price goes up, everybody's going to want to be supplying it. And farmers have a great opportunity there. Farmers will grow whatever the market demands, you know, and every farmer sits down, looks at last year's prices, takes a guess at what next year's price is going to be, and farms accordingly. And if that farmer looks at last year's carbon price, and it was double the year before, and he thinks, well, it's going to be double that again this year, then that farmer's going to grow carbon. And I know it just sounds odd, but the fact is, you know, all the high-tech ways of capturing carbon from the atmosphere are expensive. They use a lot of energy to do it. The farmer uses sunshine energy and carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to produce carbon biomass that they can then lock up in the ground. No other system on the planet has a ready-made, you know, the factory is already there. The production system is already there because we've got 1.5 billion hectares of farmland out there. And all we have to do is change the way we use it to make it the most effective single way of reducing the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. That's obviously half the equation. The other half, you know, what we don't want is a situation where everybody says, right, you know, the farmers are capturing all the carbon, let's go to a stag party in Estonia this weekend because, you know, we don't have to worry about that anymore. And that, I think, is where David Miliband's recent announcement of a carbon ration of exactly the same amount of carbon for every citizen is going to make a real difference, because people will change their habits as far as carbon emission. They will switch the lights off when they leave a room and all the rest of it. But also, when you buy organic food or food that's carbon plus, it will be cheaper than buying food that's been produced at the expense of our atmosphere. And that's going to be a very interesting phenomenon when organic food is cheaper, potentially, than non-organic food, because all of the externalized costs are taken into account. And this calculation has been done many times on the basis of pollution and other things, but when you throw carbon in the equation as well, it exaggerates the relative benefit of organic. Or, you know, I don't even really just want to beat the organic drum, although obviously I'm happy to do that all day long. The fact is that even a farmer who is using fertilizer could use that fertilizer to maximize crop growth, not use herbicides, and still have a large amount of biomass, and that is carbon, you know, plus water and other elements, to leave in the soil every year. Of course, yes, they must grow food too. And there is an issue about food already on this planet, which is there are a lot of people who are going hungry. There's another issue, which is there are people who are eating so much food that they're dying of obesity and heart disease and various other problems. And those are social problems, but to a certain extent, they're caused by the fact that our government policy encourages the cheapest possible meat and dairy products, particularly in America, where hamburgers are still 99 cents, and the agricultural policy keeps on moving the goalposts to ensure that McDonald's can always sell a hamburger for 99 cents, and that Coca-Cola can use corn sweeteners that are also subsidized. And so you've got a situation where, on the one hand, governments are saying, eat healthy. On the other, government policy is ensuring that fruit, vegetables, whole grain foods, all the kind of healthy stuff they tell us to eat, costs more than the cheap, industrialized, processed, fatty meats and sugary products.
Okay. I mean, I understand that some organic food purchases in the UK are growing at quite a considerable rate each year. Do you know what the figure is off the top of your head?
Well, it varies by sector. You know, my background in the chocolate business is that we've been growing at 70% a year and have now 10% of the total market for bar chocolate in Britain is for organic chocolate. Mm. With dairy products, it's getting close to that level as well. Mm. Meat has been a slow starter, and organic meat is starting to take off. But the rate of growth has never, if you look at the total rate of growth since 1974, when the organic market was 3 million pounds, to now when it's nearly 2 billion, if you just take a calculator and multiply it up, it's 30% growth year on year, compound growth.
Right.
Since 1974. And it's dropped as low as 10 or 15%, and it's been as high as 40 or 50%. But on average, it's just been a steady 30%.
Okay.
People keep thinking, oh, well, it's too big now. It's going to plateau out. It'll be 5% or 10% next year. And it still continues to amaze.
Demand in the UK seems to be outstripping domestic production. There's not enough organic farming in the UK to keep pace with the demand.
Yeah.
Bearing in mind the need to localise food production, how do we go about increasing production in the UK?
Well, the opposite of what we're doing. If you look at China, Heilongjiang province, one province of China has said that by 2008, they're already halfway there, but by 2008, 3.3 million hectares of land will be organic in that one province. And which is equal to all of Britain's arable land. So just one province of China will have an area of organic land equal to all of Britain's. So when you buy sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, apples, things like that, there's a good chance they'll have come from those growers in China. Because the government policy there has been to encourage farmers to go organic. When you have a government policy that discourages farmers from going organic, that actually puts obstacles in their way and ensures that it's more expensive up and down the line, you're bound to get fewer farmers going organic. The policy that is gradually being squeezed out of DEFRA here is to support more environmental forms of farming. But, you know, they didn't invent organic, and so they don't feel that comfortable about getting too enthusiastic about it. But it's changing, and it's frustrating. Farmers are notoriously conservative anyway, but when it costs them money to go organic, then they're not going to. They will catch up with the market. It takes time, but you know what we've seen is, I think Sainsbury's is a good example. 45% of what they sold in fruit and vegetables was UK sourced, and so they set themselves a target of 55%. And the buyers went out and aggressively chased their suppliers to bring it up to 55%. After a year, they did a retrospective analysis, and they found they'd overshot, and they were up to 65%. So farmers can do it.
That was Craig Sams, Soil Association Chair and founder of Whole Earth Foods and Green and Black's Chocolate, speaking on the phone from Hastings at the end of last year and explaining how he thinks making the transition to organic farming worldwide would take us halfway to our global greenhouse gas reduction target. There's a lecture that Sams gave back in 2005, reprinted on his website, which is well worth reading. The address is simply www.craigsams.com, and the Soil Association have a number of papers they are developing on the topic of organic farming and climate change at www.soilassociation.org. You've been listening to The 2 Degree Show, produced for Resonance FM in London and rebroadcast by 6 other community radio stations across the UK. And you can hear the show again by going to the archive, which is at CoinNet. That's coinet.org.uk/climateradio.